brought us through to be together on Resurrection Sunday and to be gathered around God's word as we celebrate his great victory over sin and death. We've been thinking about the meals of Jesus, and I think there's a dynamic of grace and forgiveness that raises a bit of a dilemma for us. You think about the stories that we've heard so far. So Levi was a tax collector, the sinful woman was a prostitute. They exactly fulfill the criteria that Jesus is accused of, spending too much time with tax collectors and prostitutes. And Jesus has come back at that accusation with this little bit of spiritual mathematics. Big forgiveness, big love. Big forgiveness leads to big love. But here's the little dilemma that we can kind of tease out in the time we've got this morning. The stories work and hold up if you've got a kind of dramatic conversion story. If you're someone who is aware that you've been forgiven much, and especially if you're someone who can remember, like the like Levi or the sinful woman, the moment where the grace of God came to you, it feels like you're front and centre. The stories of Jesus, the meals of Jesus work for you. Here's the dilemma. How do you get in touch with the transforming power of grace if you just haven't been that bad? I think that's a challenge, especially for kids who are raised in church. And I'm one of those kids. I was raised in church. And as we're raised in church, we know the grace of God and the ways of God. And as we grow up in church, we often have the advantage of knowing God from our youth, of never having a time where we didn't know him. But does that confer on us a kind of weird disadvantage? A kind of, a spiritual disability where we can't know what Levi or the woman knew. We miss out on that. And now I'm setting this up as a genuine question. So if you're listening to this and you're thinking, oh, he's going to say any moment now that he's going to lull me into a trap, and I'm saying, not that bad, and you say, yeah, I'm not that bad, and then I'm going to jump on you and say, yes, you are. You're terrible. That's not where this is going. So what I'm saying is, I'm talking to you if you believe, as I do, that you are a sinner saved by the grace of God. That the only way you can know God is through his forgiveness, and that it cost the death of Jesus to win you. I'm talking to you, right? So I'm not doing a theological trap to try to get you in. But I'm saying that, what if you are that person, you know that, you believe that, but just by the nature of the case, you're just not plugged into that dramatic experience of having kind of a life that spun out of control and was far from God the way Levi was. You don't have that, shattering experience of God coming into your life like the woman had. Does that leave you just kind of the walking wounded? That one of the problems that in life you're going to face as a Christian is that you're just going to, small forgiveness, small love. That you'll never really be able to arc that up in the way that she was able to, the way that Levi was able. Is it a dilemma? You've either got to choose big forgiveness, big love, or grow up in a Christian family, pick one. You're just kind of stuck in that place. That's the dilemma. Make sense? What do you do with that? Now, people have got different solutions here. So the Amish community is a very small, very conservative Christian community in the East Coast, in the eastern parts of the United States. They eschew technology, they're pacifists, they have very conservative kind of gender roles and lifestyles. And so a very attractive community in lots of ways in the way they think about living out faith in Jesus. They have a solution, and it's called Rumspringer. And what you do with Rumspringer is, when you grow up in an Amish community, very conservative, no phones, no telly, no nothing like that, at 16, you're allowed to just go off and go wild. And then for a year or so, you can just do, you can smoke, and you can kind of watch telly, you can just do whatever you want. The surveillance stops. And then you've got the choice. This is before you're baptized. They are a kind of Credo Baptist outfit and a Baptist kind of tradition. And so that's before you're baptized. Then you can come back into the community once you've had that experience and get baptized, and then you're in. What do you think about that as a solution? Now, I think as I look around, I can kind of see that the parents are going, absolutely not. This is not. And I think the young people are like, we can explore this. This is something to work with here. That is one possible solution. The other one is to just kind of up the guilt on the finite kind of sins that you're aware of. To not do more bad stuff, that's the Rumspringer solution, but to feel worse about the stuff that you've already done. And I think that's interesting because I think that A, that's closer to true, and B, it's very common in experience. A very common strategy for kids who grew up in the church is to double down on feeling worse and worse about the things that you have done. And that's not 100% wrong. I think the Rumspringer thing is kind of a bad idea. There's a version of that in evangelical culture as well where you kind of feel bad. I feel bad. They didn't have like a particularly dramatic testimony, and so you'd kind of beef up your existing situation, or you'd say, oh, just my life, it just spun out of control. I was like, I was listening to Ed Sheeran and staying up past 10 o'clock, and I got a B minus in a test, and it just was wild. And so you get the kind of evangelical Rumspringer, or you can just think, well, every sin before God is just filthy, which it is, and every sin warrants the judgment of God, which it does, and every sin needed the death of Jesus to pay for it, which it does. Correct, correct, correct. Therefore, if I just feel worse about those things, I'll be able to tap into that energy. But I don't think that's right. So I want to share with you this story. In the short time that we have before we take the Lord's Supper, the story is in Luke chapter 15, and I think it gives us a clue as to a way forward in our dilemma. Now, we just read the story of the prodigal son. It comes in a context, and the context, notice this, given what we've been thinking about over the past few weeks. It's in verse 1 of chapter 15 of the Gospel of Luke. Notice the question to which the story of the prodigal son is the answer. Now, the tax collectors and sinners were all gathered around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." The story of the prodigal son is his answer to that question. And by now, that's a familiar question, and it's a very familiar cast. You've got three characters, if you're casting this as a play. You've got Jesus, you've got the tax collectors and prostitutes, and you've got the Pharisees and teachers of the law. Three groups, Jesus in the middle, and they are saying, our problem with you, Jesus, Pharisees and tax collectors, is that you're spending too much time with them. This man welcomes sinners and eats with them. Well, by the time we're at chapter 15, I think probably the gloss is, this man still welcomes sinners and eats with them. We've raised this problem with him already. We've already talked with him about this. We've pointed out the problem, the issues that he's creating for himself and for others, and it's like he's just not listening. He won't change his behavior. And Jesus tells these stories. In fact, he tells three stories as his answer to this accusation that he just can't put to bed. And there are three stories about lost things. And the first one in verse 4, he says, you know this story, if suppose one of you has 100 sheep, you lose one of them. Don't you leave them in the open countryside and go out and look for the lost sheep? And when you find it, don't you have a party and celebrate and you bring it on its shoulders and you say to your friends and neighbours, rejoice with me, I've found my lost sheep. Now remember, Jesus is answering the accusation of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. Why do you spend so much time with sinners? And he says, you get it. You know what it's like when you lose something? Everything gets a little bit out of proportion. Your attention gets a little bit lopsided. That's what he's saying. He's saying you've got 99 sheep and you lose one, and suddenly the whole day is about one sheep. Right? 99. He specifically says you leave the 99 in the open countryside. That is, you're slightly irrational about lost things. Because now they're in danger and you're off looking for this lost sheep. And then the lost sheep comes back. Now there are 99 other sheep who are doing the right thing. except their life got a little bit more dangerous because the shepherd was off looking for the lost sheep. And then the shepherd comes back with the one lost sheep and he says, let's have a big party. Which, at that point, if you're one of the 99, you're like, for what? Like, he got lost. Anyone could do that. We're the ones who could have stayed here. But what Jesus is saying is it's like that when you lose things. You know, it seems like there's been a very beautiful community to be a part of. But you guys are not good at keeping track of your glasses. Just a little thing. But, you know, you see that, and, you know, if you kind of lose your glasses, I need my glasses to read. And just like the whole day, you kind of, until you find them, people are talking to you and saying, oh, that's really good to meet. And you're sort of, yeah, but I'm just, well, I want to find my glasses. And the whole thing is that, and that's what he's saying about the lost sheep. And then the second story is the story of the lost coin. So this time it goes to the woman, and the woman's got 9 coins, and she loses one. And again, in a very kind of relatable thing, 9, 1, whole day's about the one. Everything else, by the end of the day, the washing's not done, the meal's not cooked, the vacuum cleaning hasn't happened because you spent the whole day looking for this one coin. And then, the kind of to compound the irrationality of it, she brings home the one coin, and then she goes and says to her friends and neighbours, come and celebrate with me, I found the lost coin. And again, I think, like, if I'm that neighbour, like, okay, great for you, like, sure. Like, as in, I mean, you have to really love her, right? To think, I am so empathetic to you that your finding of a lost thing is enough for me to come and celebrate with you. And that's the context for the third story, the story of the prodigal son. This one is the most famous. The man has 2 sons. The younger son says to his father, give me my share of the inheritance. He goes to a far country. He squanders all his wealth in wild living. Severe famine hits the land and he begins to be in need. And so they go and he hires himself out to a citizen of that country. And he gets to that rock bottom point where he's jealous of pigs. So he's feeding pigs and he's looking what pigs are eating. And he says, they are on a better wicket than me. So at that point, is it Jesus' best story? I think so, in terms of crafting at least, I think it is. But he gets to rock bottom, and it's only when he gets to rock bottom, right? He's kind of like his rumspringer. If you ask him halfway through, you say, how do you feel about leaving the family? He's going, it's good so far. It's when he runs out of money. And when he's jealous of the pigs, at that point he says, I'm going to go home. And he kind of gets what he's done because he has this little speech prepared where he says, this is insane. I'm starving to death. My father's servants have got a better life than I do. So I'm going to go home and I've got a little speech. I'm going to say, Father, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son, but make me one of your hired servants. So he's, you know, practicing as you do when you're nervous. You practice the speech as you go in, and he goes home and walks down the path. And verse 20. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him and ran to his son and threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son tries to get his rehearsed line out, but the father cuts him off and he says, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Bring a ring for his finger and sandals for his feet. Kill the fatted calf. Let's have a feast and celebrate. This warrants a party. This warrants a feast. Now, Tim Keller has pointed out that the word prodigal, this is good for your trivia nights, it doesn't mean wayward. It means lavish. The word prodigal means big spender. Means someone who doesn't keep track of their accounts. It's someone who is over the top in the way they spend and manage their resources. And on that basis, Tim Keller has argued that the story probably shouldn't be called the story of the prodigal son, but the story of the prodigal father. Because it's the father that is lavish. It's the father that's over the top. It's the father that's the big spender. And his son comes. He's already lost half the estate to his son. And he's about to blow a whole bunch more money by killing the fatted calf and getting a fancy robe and rings and wine and the party and so on. And that's the story. And pause. If it ended there, what would it mean? If the story ended there, then the story would be an answer to the question of the tax collectors and sinners. It would be a story that answers the question of the tax collector and sinner, which is, Jesus, why do you love us? And it would be a beautiful answer to that question, right? Because of the Father's love for you. But remember, it's not the question that he's answering. The question has not come from the tax collectors and sinners. They're not saying, Jesus, why do you love us? It's the Pharisees and the teachers of the law who are saying, Jesus, why do you love them? Why are you treating them the way that you do? That's the question that he's answering, and so the story has to go on. Verse 25, meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came to the house, he heard the music and the dancing, and so he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. Your brother's come home, and your father's killed the fatted calf because he's back safe and sound. How many oldest children? Youngest? Okay, you guys are the worst. Like, you're the oldest kid, right? And it's just like your parents, that between you and me, they don't know what they're doing yet. And when parents don't know what they're doing, they err on the side of caution. So there's all these rules about what you can and can't do, and you can't have any screen time, and you're not allowed to go out with your friends, you're not allowed to go to sleepovers, and you're like, your parents are like saying, well, okay, you can watch Peppa Pig, but only under supervision, and there's a few episodes that we've screened and they're not okay or whatever. And then by the time you get to the youngest kid, it's just like they're putting Coca-Cola on their cereal in the morning, and they're kind of watching Die Hard, and you think, hey, you're the oldest kid, and you're looking at the youngest kid, and you think, what? Like, I did this, and they get away with that. So I'm older, so younger kids, you guys are rubbish. Because it's just so not fair. But then you can tell younger kids, I can always tell the younger kids, they're so happy. They just... My image of a younger kid, like, you know, the older kid's always neurotic and so on. The younger kid, it's like we've got four kids, and maybe they're, I don't know if he's here, so anyway, we can expunge this from the record. But my picture of the youngest kid is, it's like there's a four-person bicycle, you know, those bicycles, and the first three are like pedaling, and the last kid's just got his feet up on the thing. He's like, I've worked this out, I can just make it go through. This story is for oldest children. Because the oldest son is there, and they haven't even told him about the party. That's not fair. It's like he's out there, he's doing the work, he's managing the estate, he's working on the farm, and no one even thought to say, oh, there's a party. And so he just hears this like, it's like, what's going on there? And so he's kind of, you know, cleans his hands and stuff and goes into the house and he goes and stands outside and he gets a servant and says, what's going on? And he says, your brother's back. And they've killed a fatted calf for him, and they've kind of lavished all this stuff on him, and he's back, and there's this huge party, and he's like, did he like win a Nobel Prize? Did he get the Rhodes Scholarship? And they're like, oh no, he took the estate and lost it all, and then he came home. And you're like, yeah, we could all do that, buddy. And so the father eventually has to come out, and the father does what he did with the youngest son. Remember, with the youngest son, the father runs down the road. With the older son, he runs out into the field. And the father comes out and pleads with him. And he answers his father, he says, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, and you never gave me even a goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours squandered your property with prostitutes, he comes home and you kill the fatted calf. Everything he says is true, right? That's actually literally what happened. The father says, my son, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we have to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. did the older son come in and join the party? We don't know. The story ends at that point. We know what happened with the people to whom the story was first given. Because I honestly think this is Jesus reaching out to the Pharisees and to the tax collectors and saying, guys, there's a way of being a part of this. You can get involved here. You can be part of this mission. You can be part of these kind of messianic feasts that are brought into the present. You can be part of this outflowing of the grace of God. Just come join the party. Just come and celebrate that Levi was lost and he's found, that this brother of yours has come home, that this sister of yours was living out and she's come home. You can be a part of the grace of God by being part of that. By putting aside your pride and putting aside your rights and just not being, and I could say this fellow older kid to older kid, just not being prissy. Just not being someone who stands on fairness, because you know what? It's like fairness or grace. Pick one. That's the choice. And so the Pharisees sadly did not take their opportunity. Jesus reached out their hand, oh Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who I love and long for. Jesus gave them an opportunity and they could have come and joined the party and they walked away. And the application for us is that to be part of the kingdom of God, and especially if you're raised in a Christian context where you knew this stuff already, the way you tap into the grace of God and know that big love that brings big forgiveness, it's not by the Rumspringer method. It's not even, I think, by the kind of maximized guilt method. It's by coming and joining the party. It's by looking sideways and thinking, oh, God gives his grace to people like that, to like younger brothers. Like, okay, that's good. And your choice is where you hear the. Do you think, oh, I'm a white guy, I don't dance? Or do you think, forget it. Grace is so good. The gospel is so good. The love of God is so good that I don't care which person I end up having to call brother or sister as a result. In fact, I kind of love it. Because I love that we worship a God who is like that. There's more celebrating in heaven over one sinner that rejoices. And our choice is to come and join that party and to say, I like the unfair, lavish grace of heaven. It's great. And it's the thing that we're in